This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As protesters continue to condemn police brutality and racism nationwide following the death of George Floyd, Reuters opinion poll shows that an overwhelming majority of Americans, including most of President Donald Trump's Republican Party, support sweeping law enforcement reforms. 82% of Americans want to ban police from using chokeholds, and 83% want to ban racial profiling. 92% want federal police to be required to wear body cameras, and 91% support allowing independent investigations of police departments that show patterns of misconduct. The poll showed bipartisan support for many proposals put forth by Democratic lawmakers in recent days for changes to police departments in the United States. The White House and Republican lawmakers are preparing their own plan for changes in policing, though they are expected to fall short of the deep reforms being sought by Democrats in Congress. Mr. Trump, who has been trying to win back suburban voters by positioning himself as a law and order president, has called on states to crack down on unrest and previously said that he could use military forces if protests are not quelled. A statue of Robert Baden Powell, the founder of the Scouts, is to be removed from a town in southern England. Critics say while he's hailed for creating the worldwide scouting movement, he also held racist views and supported Adolf Hitler and fascism. A pool council is to remove the statue. It will be held in storage while local communities discuss an appropriate future for it. Black Lives Matter demonstrations sweeping across the United States and Europe have reignited a debate in Britain about monuments to those involved in its imperialist past. A spokesman for the Scouts said the organization was looking forward to discussing the Baden-Powell statue's future with the council to make an informed decision on what happens next. This is VOA News. Globally, there are more than 420,000 confirmed deaths from COVID-19, and in the United States, nearly 114,000. The number of confirmed infections is more than 7.5 million globally and more than 2 million in the U.S. The latest data on U.S. jobless claims shows both a continued drop in those seeking benefits and an historically high number of people out of work. New claims fell to 1.5 million. That's the 10th straight weekly decline, according to government data released Thursday. But that figure is still more than twice as high as the number of Americans who sought the benefits at the peak of the Great Recession. And in another sobering gut check, those relying on jobless benefits beyond the first week known as continuing claims still hovers around an eye-popping 21 million. Thursday's data served as a reminder of the long road to recovery that lies ahead for the U.S. economy, despite a solid bounce back in hiring last month. Rio's Copacabana Beach, normally bustling with locals and tourists basking in the sun in a non-pandemic world, turned into a metaphor overnight. Activist group Rio de Paz dug 100 symbolic graves to illustrate the country's fight to contain the coronavirus. Brazil has the second highest number of coronavirus cases globally and the third highest fatalities from COVID-19 at more than 800,000 infected and approximately 41,000 dead. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who once described the coronavirus as a little flu, has drawn sharp criticism from around the country for his handling of the crisis. Rio de Paz coordinator Antonio Carlos Costa is adding his name to the list of critics, saying that the public deserves messages of hope, action, and solidarity from the government during a time like this. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden called out Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, demanding that Facebook crack down on misinformation and fact-check politicians' ads. In an open letter to Zuckerberg, the Biden campaign encouraged supporters to use the hashtag #MoveFastFixIt, a play on Facebook's Move Fast and Break Things motto, and signed a petition for Facebook to remove false information, fact-check political ads, and in the 2 weeks leading up to the November election, and enforce clear rules that apply to everyone, including President Trump, that prohibit threatening behavior and so-called lies about how to participate in the election. The letter puts more pressure on Facebook to change its policies on political ads and speech after its smaller rival Twitter began fact-checking the president's tweets, including a post from Mr. Trump about mail-in ballots that Twitter labeled with an exclamation point and a message urging users to get the facts. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Friday, June 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party demands an independent investigation into an attack on its leader.
We called upon the authorities in Tanzania to take this matter seriously. As you said, this thing had nothing to do except the work of Honorable Mbowe.
Kenyans are expected to finance next fiscal year's budget. A clinic in Cameroon helps victims traumatized by separatist conflict. Ethiopia races to stave off coronavirus in refugee camps. And hundreds of Nigerian asylum seekers are missing in the Netherlands.
The Dutch police should create a specific West African human trafficking unit, which invests in knowledge and expertise and is well connected to the West African community that we have here in the Netherlands.
And Zimbabweans are trying to figure out what's causing the rise in the COVID-19 cases. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party is demanding an independent and thorough investigation into the attack on its leader, Freeman Mbowe. The party says it is displeased with statements from the police saying they are following the case after the attack, which led to Mr. Mbowe's hospitalization. The party's remarks come after party leaders Thursday visited Mr. Mbowe at the hospital where he is receiving medical attention. The party said he's responding well to treatment after undergoing surgery. Chadema spokesperson Tumaini Makeni tells viewers Peter Clotty that now is the time for the government to demonstrate its commitment to the rule of law and justice by launching an impartial inquiry into the attack that will bring the perpetrators to justice.
We have thanked and praised God for how he's the national chairperson of the Chadema and the leader of opposition in Tanzania, Honorable Freeman Mbowe. So far, he underwent an operation. I've been in the theater room yesterday, almost in the top of the day. He was operated. Now he's still under caring of the doctor that is Aga Khan, where he has been given almost 72 at least hours to have a proper lethargy so that he can keep receiving the proper medication.
Now, so let me ask you, I understand your party has condemned the attack on him and is calling for an independent investigation into this. Is this the case? Is this accurate?
Yeah, sure. I called upon the authorities in Tanzania to take this matter with seriousness. As you said, categorically from the first day, this thing has nothing to do except the work of Mr. Honorable Mbowe. That is the politics here. The places where he was attacked at his home, the buildings in the compound where some other government officials have their home there, and we don't see any other thing out of business of that is politics. But we demanded the authorities to make a proper and take this matter very seriously and make a proper and independent investigation so that the match is brought to the public and we know the culprit and the perpetrators who are they or who are behind. They could be brought to the law and just seem to be done.
Since you officially engaged the government, what has been the response? Are you satisfied with the response so far?
So far, we showed our satisfaction the way our police put their first gear into this matter. Just the morning of the attack past midnight on the day before yesterday, in the morning, the police, their first official statement was like trying to show this, trying to take this issue like a normal thing, like using this word, people should not politicize the matter. So our question was, if you guys have not even done any proper investigation on this matter, just happened in the past night and the last night and in the morning, you're saying these things should not be taken like that. It's nothing to do with politics, and it should be taken like a normal, any other hooligan event. They said, no, you've not even done a proper investigation into this matter. Why are you coming out quickly with this conclusive remark? And we said, no, the police should take their time and make a proper investigation. So we are still waiting for, and we hope the police will take this matter seriously, as you said, and take our call very seriously. So we are still waiting for them to do their due investigation as we called upon the day before yesterday.
Tumaini Makeni is the spokesperson for the main opposition Chadema Party of Tanzania. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. Kenya's Treasury Ministry has presented a 2.7 trillion shillings budget for the 2020-2021 financial year, which begins July 1st. In presenting the budget on Thursday, Cabinet Secretary Oko Yateni outlined spending plans, including taxation measures to finance the budget and also a stimulus package to revive an economy affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, economists say the government will have some difficulties funding the budget due to unemployment caused by COVID-19.
The 2020-2021 financial year budget stands at 2.79 trillion Kenya shillings, lower than last year's 3.08 trillion, and the government has already burdened Kenyans to cater for 1.6 trillion through taxation. Treasury Cabinet Secretary Ukur Yatani said that at least 56 billion Kenya shillings have been set to revive affected sectors, among them tourism and agriculture, which are the most hit. Yatani said this year's economy is expected to grow at 4.9% of GDP in 2020-2021 and end with 3.0% of GDP over the medium term.
This year we were looking at 5.4, but we are likely to realize that the growth is going to go down to 2.5. 2.5% of GDP to, if we are lucky, to 3%. Regarding debt relief, we appreciate the initiative of the G20 to press for a debt moratorium for about 6-7 months to December. We are still not sure. We are trying to push for better terms, because what's happening is that some of the conditions attendant to debt relief are quite punitive because it will block us from further borrowing.
Over the last few months, revenue collections in Kenya shrank considerably due to slowed economic activities attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic. Mr. Yatani said more cash has been set aside to boost the economy.
Faced with limited resources, the balancing has not been easy. We have channeled resources to cushion citizens and businesses from the adverse effects of COVID-19 pandemic, as well as interventions to support economic recovery. I firmly believe that the measures spelled out in this budget will create more jobs and transform the lives of Kenyans. At the heart of these measures is our commitment to protect the lives and livelihood of citizens and support recovery of business.
However, economists say there is a 0% probability that the country's economy will grow in the next 6 months. Economist Ali Khan Sachu said that the government may end up borrowing the money to fund its budget, which may be very difficult as most Kenyans have been rendered jobless due to economic hard times caused by the COVID-19 pandemic.
There is practically a zero probability of a stabilization of this economy in the next 6 months. With respect to the economy, companies are now beginning to cut back, and we're going to get a slew of job losses, far more than we've had so far. Essentially, I think this budget is totally not reflecting reality.
Due to COVID-19, the government in its budget has also waived the Kenya National Examination fees for students who were supposed to sit for the exams later in the year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
A group of investigative reporters says almost half of Nigerian asylum seekers arriving in the Netherlands last year disappeared. It is believed that many fell victim to human traffickers who forced them into prostitution or drug trafficking across the European Union. Martha van der Wolf reports from Amsterdam.
A European journalism collective says of the 2,461 Nigerians seeking asylum in the Netherlands in 2019, 961 cannot be located. Another 128 Nigerians who arrived in January of this year also disappeared, according to an investigation by the journalist group Lost in Europe. Reacting to the investigative group's findings, Shamir Kaliers of the Dutch Center Against Human and Child Trafficking says the results are not surprising because they follow a pattern that has been going on for years. The non-governmental organization says more has to be done in the Netherlands to protect the Nigerian men and women who are victims of human traffickers.
The Dutch police should create a specific West African Human Trafficking Unit, which invests in knowledge and expertise and is well connected to the West African community that we have here in the Netherlands. And by using this and creating this expertise, the Dutch police would be well equipped to prosecute these trafficking rings.
Young people from Nigeria are lured with promises of better life in Europe. After arriving in the European Union, often by crossing the Mediterranean Sea by boat, they are forced to work in prostitution or other forms of forced labor. It is a profitable business for the traffickers, as each person has to pay off a debt up to $50,000. It is believed that such trafficking is not just a Dutch problem, but that the criminal organizations behind such illegal practices are active across Western Europe. The Dutch National Prosecutor for Human Trafficking and People Smuggling, Warner ten Kate, says more international cooperation is needed to prevent human trafficking.
Within Europe, it's essential to work together and to exchange experiences, but also exchange data of the missing children and women and men. So if they disappear and pop up somewhere in conditions considering human trafficking, they can easily be identified. I think that that's really essential, and to give them the protection they need.
A Europe-wide police investigation on missing Nigerian women in 2006 led to arrests across Europe and Nigeria. Despite that, the trafficking has not stopped or discouraged Nigerians from migrating. The International Organization for Migration says the increase has been significant, from 1,500 arrivals of Nigerian women in 2014 to 11,000 in 2016. The IOM worries that up to 80% are potential victims of trafficking. Flavio Diacomo of the IOM warns that data shows it's not only Nigerians who are being trafficked into Europe from West Africa.
We have also seen, even last year, an increase of women victims of trafficking coming from Ivory Coast, which is quite new, and they are mainly coming from Tunisia. This is a different kind of exploitation, because it's not only sexual exploitation, but also work exploitation and domestic exploitation. Ivorian girls who were exploited in Tunisia and then re-trafficked in Italy.
Members of the Dutch parliament questioned the government's approach to missing people this week. Earlier this year, it was reported by Lost in Europe that at least 25 pregnant West African women had disappeared from asylum centers in the Netherlands. Their disappearance raised serious concerns about potential baby trafficking and illegal adoption. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Amsterdam.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 12th. The ongoing separatist conflict in Cameroon's western regions has created a growing humanitarian emergency that has affected close to 2 million people. Humanitarian experts say those displaced by the fighting need help resettling, but also psychological support. A clinic in Cameroon's capital provides rare trauma therapy for those affected, as Moki Edwin Kinzika narrates in this report by Anne Unzuanke in Yaoundé.
51-year-old Judith Ndome says rebels in Cameroon's southwest invaded her farm in 2018, demanding she give them money. When she refused, they beat her, took her farm and burned it to the ground. The attack left her traumatized and unable to sleep.
I'm sick. My farm's all I used to sit.
She says she is
sick. Of my farm.
Her farm is where she used to sit. Judith says she thinks about her farms. Her farms gave her food. Even when she was not working, her farms were producing. She doesn't want to think about it anymore. But how does she stop thinking about that? Ndume fled her village to Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, where she found help at a unique trauma center run by the Hope and Rehabilitation Organization. Psychologist Cyril Masala says when people have undergone therapy, at least 80 to 90% of them will come out improved and will be able to reintegrate into society and help others. Dr. Masala says the trauma healing is a learning session for a new life. Hope and Rehabilitation say they have helped over 1,200 internally displaced people like Ndume since starting the clinic 4 years ago. The group also gives food aid to IDPs and plans to start job training if it can get enough donor funding.
We want to organize a session whereby these IDPs will be trained on income-generating activities. We will train them. We don't want a situation where IDPs come, they give them just food, then they go back. We want to train them so that they can become independent and sustainable.
Kwame Mendi Fricks, the National Coordinator of Hope and Rehabilitation Organization, says the NGO wants to organize a session whereby internally displaced persons would be trained on income-generating activities. Kwame Mendi adds the NGO doesn't want a situation where internally displaced people will just receive food. The NGOs want to train them so that they can become independent and sustainable. Cameroon's ongoing military-separatist clashes in the western regions mean the need for trauma therapy will only grow. The United Nations says the conflict has impacted the lives of nearly 2 million people, including more than 500,000 displaced, and claimed some 3,000 lives. For Anne Zwanke in Yaoundé, Moki Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News.
Zimbabweans aren't sure whether the continuing rise of COVID-19 cases in quarantine centers is due to citizens bringing the virus back from other countries or if they are infecting each other. Rutando Mawere reports from Harare.
The High Court in April ordered government to improve conditions at quarantine centers in response to a filing from the Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights that claimed failure to provide facilities that meet World Health Organization regulations. Chairperson of ZADA, Dr. Fortune Nyamande, claims there has been no change in the facilities. He attributes the rising numbers of positive cases to returnees infecting each other during quarantine, but Health Minister Obadiah Moyo says it is difficult to conclude that.
So the issue regarding the infectivity rate within the quarantines, you know, is a reflection of the fact that the disease is coming from outside. We cannot overrule that, you know. It's not happening elsewhere. It's happening within the quarantine areas, right? How do we distinguish whether one had the disease before or after they entered the quarantine? That's a very tricky one. You know, all we know is that we are picking candidates who are positive within the quarantine areas.
Due to shortages of test kits, government is doing a screening as the returnees arrive, then testing them after several days in quarantine. Moyo says to ascertain that returnees will not infect each other, they will now aim to test each one on the first day.
You know, right now, I don't think it makes any good sense for us to be saying maybe it has started there. We're going to isolate and be able to come up with that position the minute we start testing with PCR on day one. We already put systems in place, you know, so that, you know, we test everyone with using PCR. That is what we are doing now. Rapid screening is just for screening, as it says.
Former Minister of Health, Henry Madzorera, believes the returning residents could be infecting each other.
There is definitely a big risk of transmission of COVID-19 within the quarantine areas. If we look at the prevalence rates of COVID-19 from the populations within the quarantine, our quarantine areas, and compare it with the source where they are coming from, let's say South Africa, you find that the prevalence of COVID-19 is much higher within our quarantine areas. That might suggest that there is transmission within the quarantine areas happening.
Returning residents have been the major source for positive results. The country has recorded 320 positive cases as of yesterday, with the 6 new cases being returnees from South Africa. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the trial of Lamine Diack, the former head of World Athletics, who told the French court on Thursday that he has slowed the handling of Russian doping cases between 2011 and 2013 to save a sponsorship deal with a Russian bank. The 87-year-old Senegalese said he had not sought to protect the athletes caught up in the scandal, some of whom later competed in the London 2012 Olympics, but to ensure the cases did come to public attention all at once. This, he said, would have caused a scandal. Lamine Diack, who is on trial for corruption, said he did so to allow the Russian athletes to compete in the 2012 London Olympics and the World Championships in Moscow. VOA's Nicolas Pinalot tells us more.
According to French prosecutors, Diack directly or indirectly demanded almost $4 million from Russian athletes in order to have their names cleared in an illicit system known as full protection. Another revelation in court today when Lamine Diack claimed he had been flabbergasted to learn from prosecutors that his son Papa Massa Diack had get involved in the doping cases. He said that if what the prosecutors had told him was true, his son behaved like a thug. Lamine Diack, who was once one of the most powerful leaders in Olympic sport, is being tried for corruption, money laundering and breach of trust. The charges carry a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News in Paris.
Current 400 meters world and Olympic record holder, South African Wade van Niekerk, says there is no reason why he cannot break his own world record. Wayne van Niekerk stomped over the finish line to clinch gold at the Rio 2016 Olympics, breaking Michael Johnson's 17-year-old 400 meters world record in the process. He is confident he can still challenge for international gold medals and wants to go where no man has gone before, to run a sub 43 seconds 400 meters.
The world record in 2016 seemed quite impossible for many. So the reality for me is that I know that I still have a lot of room to improve myself, so much room to better myself as an athlete. So only time can tell where the investments that I've put into my body physically and mentally will take me. But for me as a 400 meter athlete and the current world record holder, it's the only thing that I meditate on. It's the only thing I work towards, is to break that record again.
In football news, FIFA says players will be allowed to play for up to 3 clubs instead of 2 during the course of a season in a temporary rule change to alleviate the effects of the novel coronavirus pandemic on the sports. The global soccer body added that the move was to avoid any concerns regarding unemployed players. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, June 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Border Crossings. The Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossings. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. In the wake of widespread demonstrations against racial injustice and police brutality across America, I talked with two experts about combating systemic racism in policing and concrete proposals for police reform in America. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.